Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. And yes, it's Monday morning, which means that it is time for a weekly discussion with Jimmy Sexton of the Esquire Group, who is based in Dubai. And we are working our way through the great book, Charles Adams for Good and Evil, one of his wonderful lessons at a time. And this week we are on lesson 20. And Mr. Adams writes, people tend to resist heavy taxation in the following ways. First, lawful avoidance. Second, if avoidance fails, then either evasion or flight to avoid tax. Third, rebellion. And finally, when there is no other alternative, they have accepted serfdom when it is offered the only relief from outrageous taxation. What's that last part again? When there is no other alternative, they have accepted serfdom when it is offered the only relief from outrageous taxation. Oh my God, so much in this. We've talked about these things. Well, Jimmy, I know you were feeling pretty good before you heard that. But okay, so how are you before you heard that?
Well, I was great. Considering I live in a country with no income taxes, I'm still great. But I think it's a very good, I think it's a very good statement of sort of the cycle of people trying to escape outrageous taxation, right? The one thing that I think is, I think that, and as we've discussed before, I don't think that massive evasion is really an issue anymore, because I think it's largely impossible with our digital money and automatic exchange of information protocols like the CRS and FATCA. But I think we're at that point where people have been pursuing legal avoidance. And I think what's happened is that most people can't afford legal avoidance, right? I mean, when I first got into this business many years ago, you know, you might be able to put some good strategies in place if you had, you know, let's say $5 million. But in order to set up a structure now that's going to give you any kind of advantages, I mean, you have to have $15 million on the low end. I mean, normally I would say you need at least 30 to put a proper structure in place, right? And to be able to do it legally and achieve tax avoidance. So most people can't even afford tax avoidance anymore. And a lot of them don't have the option to leave, which means they might already be in serfdom. You have the wealthy that still do have some avoidance strategies available to them, but they're becoming less and less by the day, which is why you're seeing such an increase in second citizenships, in the popularity of these residency programs that offer tax advantages, and of course, the increase in populations in places like Dubai that offer, and the Caribbean that offer tax advantage living. So I think we're definitely getting towards the end of the cycle where avoidance is even a possibility, and into the beginning of the cycle of fleeing to avoid tax. And the rest of the people are just going to be in serfdom.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about the costs of legal tax avoidance and, you know, having to have, you know, say $15 million to begin with, to be in that. Maybe there's a market. I mean, I know that your clients are these high-end people. Maybe you could set up a subsidiary of the Esquire Group instead of, you know, sort of a housing concept of Habitat for Humanity. How about Avoidance for Humanity?
Listen, if I could start a country, John, I would be on top of it in a second.
Let's dissect this a little bit. People tend to resist heavy taxation. You would agree that not only is taxation in North America and other parts of the world heavy, but it's so heavy that it's basically collapsing the foundation of society. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I would go so far as to say, with the exception of probably Switzerland, every wealth, what we consider a wealthy country, is a high tax country that has heavy taxation. I mean, I can't really think of many countries in Europe and in North America that don't have heavy taxation.
Now, you know, there are a lot of politicians who would listen to what you just said and look, well, obviously, if all of these wealthy countries have heavy taxation, they must have gotten wealthy because of heavy taxation.
No, I think they got wealthy for the opposite reason, right? I think a lot of them got wealthy because of favorable tax laws and less tax laws, right? I mean, let's not forget that they keep inventing new tax laws to tax different types of incomes, right? And to reduce the benefits, like phasing out itemized deductions and things like that, right? So it's not just the, let's say, you know, advertised tax rate, it's also everything else, right? That's kind of created a higher tax over the years.
And I think you know what? It's absolutely impossible. I mean, this weekend, today is actually the due date for tax returns in Canada. Yeah, it's a big day, you know. I mean, this weekend I was just trying to help somebody with the simplest of simple returns. Okay, the simplest, and I actually do these things. I do my tax returns by hand, actually, believe it or not.
Old school.
Well, you know, it works. Well, it's how I understand what I'm actually doing, honestly. Okay. You know, I think everybody should do their returns by hand. But you know, even this,
you know, John, that right there would solve this tax problem. If everybody by law had to do their own return by hand, there would be a revolt to throw over the tax system in the US and Canada immediately.
I think that's right. And I think so few people do it. I mean, a couple of years ago about this time, I was actually sitting in it must have been pre-COVID. It would have been the last time I was in a restaurant before pre-COVID, whatever. And I was sitting there with a bunch of stuff and I was actually doing my tax return by hand, you know, for the deadline in Canada. And somebody came up and said to me, "You can do this?" You know, as if I was royalty or something. And I said, "Well, yes." Yes.
You tax royalty.
I mean, I've been doing these things my whole life, you know. Oh, that has nothing. Oh, my God. This is a bunch of forms. OK, it's craziness. But anyway, my point is simply the simplest of the simple situations, you know, can be like 5-6 hours. And it's, you know, and nobody knows. And I was watching this discussion. I was having this discussion with somebody. And, you know, they're really, really having trouble with this. And of course, I was starting to, you know, get upset because I just wanted to get, you know, help the person get the thing done, you know. But I realized the problem was that people have no idea why the information even matters, right? So, you know, you say, well, we need this. They give you this, you know. Anyway, it's a real mess. Anyway, so we have heavy taxation, which includes heavy compliance, right? Okay. So the first resistance is lawful avoidance. And yeah, of course, you know, and that's not a pejorative term. That would include, I think, IRA contributions. Do you agree?
For sure. IRA contributions, you know, health savings account contributions. Absolutely.
So in other words, you start with the government sanctioned forms of tax avoidance here. You can defer your tax. I mean, I don't think people realize it's tax deferral, but okay. But you know, there are limits on how much you can put into an IRA. I don't actually even know.
Well, and I don't even, you know what? I take that back. I don't even know if I would say that an IRA is tax avoidance, right? Because it's really tax deferral. You're not avoiding the tax. You're just kind of kicking the can down the road.
From the government point of view, it's avoidance. From their point of view, because
yeah, that's true.
But anyway, yeah. So I mean, something like the IRA in the U.S. or the RRSP in Canada, this is, I think, on the level of avoidance for humanity. Agreed.
Yep.
Yeah. Everybody can do that type of stuff. Now, then we move it up another level. I mean, do you think that the use of entities, trusts, corporations, would you call that stuff avoidance?
We'll call it tax planning. I mean,
okay.
I would call it, yeah, I mean, look, I guess it could be. I mean, I would say it's more tax minimization. So than avoidance, because you're not all, you know, it's not an all out avoidance of taxation. You're minimizing, you're certainly minimizing the taxes you're liable for.
Okay. But even when we get into that, right, you know, all of a sudden you got to call somebody and, you know, and there's all these costs, you know, the meter starts running. But, you know, I think that, you know, and interestingly on this point, again, because I live in Canada, most of my images on this tend to be from a Canadian perspective. But, you know, Canada has single payer health care. And sometime mm-hmm. in the last decade or so, instead of the government increasing the amount that they were paid for services, et cetera, they actually gave them the legal right to create these medical corporations, right? Which, you know, created, you know, it's government sanctioned tax deferral, et cetera. But anyway, so if avoidance fails, meaning people run out of things to do, then either evasion or flight to avoid tax. Well, I agree with you on the evasion thing. I don't think there's much of it at all.
No.
But the flight, that is becoming major.
Yep.
We see this in the renunciation of U.S. citizenship, and with the caveat, okay, that it's not to avoid paying tax, it's avoid being subject to the whole incomprehensible system.
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's true. I mean, I know a lot of people that have left Europe, for example, for places like Dubai, precisely to avoid paying tax. Not so much because of the compliance. Now, I think the compliance, if you're talking about the United States, is certainly very challenging and is a very big reason why. I think from a U.S. standpoint, you know, as we've said before, when people are expatriating, I think that most of those people are doing so because of the compliance burden rather than the tax savings. But I think when you look at people leaving high tax Europe, for example, for places like the UAE or other countries that offer tax advantage living, that they're mostly doing so. I mean, those are mostly wealthy people that are doing so for reducing their tax burden.
To reduce their tax burden. Well, you know, you have a much better handle on the compliance complexity for, say, German or French tax residents or Swiss tax residents than I do. But my impression is that there is nothing that there's nothing that's even close to the complexity of the U.S. and Canadian systems. Is that your perception?
Yeah, I would say in terms of all of the tax systems that I've encountered, I mean, look, I think the U.K. and Australia probably aren't too far behind. But when I think you get into the more traditional civil law socialist countries of Europe, and the other tax systems, you know, that I've seen in Asia and stuff like that is certainly much less burdensome than the U.S. and Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the point where, I mean, I can say with absolute confidence that for North American taxpayers, they have no understanding of the tax system at all. They can't understand it. It's just completely over everybody's head. You know, it's all these separate this and that. Is that the same thing in Europe? Or,
well, you know, in Europe, I mean, in a lot of countries, for example, if you're simply an employee, you don't even file a tax return, right? Like if you're just an employee, your employer is responsible for withholding taxes from your wages and turning them over to the government. And so at the end of the year, like in Austria, for example, you just basically get a summary document from, I think it's from your employer showing like, hey, this is your gross pay. This was what was paid to the government. This is your net pay. And if you don't have any income or anything outside of that, that's it. You have nothing to file.
You just agree to it, basically.
I mean, you just don't do anything and you're not doing anything that's agreeing to it, right? I mean, and then of course, if you have rental properties or, you know, some side hustle or something like that, or, you know, some complex foreign income or something like that, then, you know, it gets a little bit more complicated and you do need to engage a professional. I don't think it's something you can do yourself, to my knowledge. Mm. But it's a very small percentage of the population that actually, you know, needs to file anything.
Yeah. Third, rebellion. Now, this is interesting. Have we got any rebellion going on? I mean, we have reactions, we have leaving. I mean, I know people, and I know more and more people who are severing tax residency with Canada. That's it. They, you know, they see the departure tax as being a good long-term investment. They may very well be right. We know people are renouncing U.S. citizenship. But what about those who rebellion sort of suggests they're going to stay and fight? What's your thought on that? What does rebellion mean in the modern world?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, I certainly think that, and I think that you're the one that has pointed this out, is that, you know, the fleeing for tax purposes is a form of rebellion, right? It's sort of a passive rebellion. If it reaches a point of actual violent rebellion, I wouldn't be so sure that it won't reach that point someday, right? I mean, look, we saw the January 6th riot in the United States. We've seen, you know, different uprisings, especially against COVID regulations and things like that. I don't think it is beyond populations to engage in a violent uprising if they really feel wrong. And I think that if it ever gets to that point with taxation, I think absolutely there will be a violent uprising.
I think it's more likely to come in the form of bank account seizures and things like that, you know, as being the precipitating factor. Canada managed to get the attention of the world with this Freedom Convoy thing a couple of months ago. And of course, part of the government of Canada's reaction, which was insane, you know, was to use as an excuse to seize bank accounts, right? And that, I think, is the type of thing that could possibly generate rebellion, I think, you know, more quickly than anything else. But, there are historical precedents for it. I mean, if you believe United States history, for example, that is at least described as a form of tax rebellion. And then finally, no other alternative. They've accepted serfdom. I think most people have accepted serfdom.
I agree.
But they still fight back because in their serfdom, you know, what they do is they say, well, I'm just not going to have any money then. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, since the government won't let me have any money, I'm going to ask the government to support me, right?
Well, I think you rightly say that, you know, more people vote for a living than work. And I think that's what's happening, right? As I think that when you look at, if you look at it from that perspective, I think we said on a podcast a while back, right? 56% of the United States population doesn't pay any income taxes. That's more than half, right? So I would say that those 56%, would you agree that those 56% are then voting for a living if they're not paying any taxes?
I think probably. I don't think consciously, but I think that probably, yeah.
Sure.
Because, you know, it's part of what, in fact, a very large part of what politics is about these days is these noises about fair share, making the rich pay, going after tax cheats, you know.
That don't exist. Tax cheats that don't exist.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. It's absolutely crazy, right? But this is the way the thing is described, and this is a way of you know, essentially buying votes, right? Or we have, I'll give you just, I will ask you what you think about this. Okay. I probably already tipped my hand, but here we go. So there is, in the province of Ontario, there is an election on June the 2nd, which is what, I guess a month from now. And these are really boring elections. I was thinking about provincial politics in Ontario. There's nothing more boring and ridiculous. Nevertheless, the current government, a couple of months ago, decided that they were going to not only cease charging annual automobile license plate stickers fees, okay, but they were going to refund the fees of people who paid for the last year, right, in advance of the election. I mean, this is amazing to me, okay? I kid you not, okay, I got a check from the Ontario government in the mail as a refund of some license plate. This is incredible to me. But this is precisely, I think, the type of irresponsible, cynical government posturing, you know, just figuring, well, you know, there's enough people who drive, so, you know, we'll give them a gift and maybe they'll vote for us.
I mean, it's an out-and-out bribe, right? I mean, it shouldn't even be legal.
You know, yeah, to the extent that it's retroactive, it is clearly a bribe, okay? You know, going forward prospectively.
Yeah, I mean, that's different.
Yeah, maybe it's different, but it's just an example of, and this can only happen in a world where people are so strapped, right? Who are just under such pressure and abuse from governments that this type of thing is enough to get their votes. I mean, I can't believe it. I mean, personally, all right, I think that is an appropriate form of taxation because cars use roads, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and I think it's a lot more reasonable than income taxation because at least it ties, you know, the government expenditure to a certain group of people. But I mean, this is, I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. You just can't make it up, right?
No, but I think that goes back to the point, right, where if getting a refund of your auto license fees is enough to sway your vote because you're just so hard up from oppressive taxation that, you know, you're living in serfdom, right?
I think that's actually an excellent, you know, I think this is great because I think we've actually arrived at the definition of serfdom in the modern world, where a minor tax refund will buy your vote.
Yeah. And I mean, and this is what I was getting at before with my comment, where, you know, if you have 56% of the population, like in the United States, not paying taxes, then in my mind, they're voting for a living, whether consciously or unconsciously, to get themselves more benefits at the expense of the, for now, 44% that's still paying taxes. I'm sure that's going to go down every year. So those 56% are essentially living in serfdom and trying to vote their way into a better life because they don't have an option at earning a better life because of the oppressive taxation of governments.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's absolutely right. And it's becoming, I think, increasingly difficult. I think it's increasingly difficult for people to acquire, accumulate capital, this sort of thing. And, you know, I think it was Margaret Thatcher who, staked her political career largely on the statement of the problem with socialism that sometime you run out of other people's money, right?
I mean, look, I think if you look at the United States and Canada, I'm going to include all, you know, high tax.
Yeah, the whole thing, to be clear. I mean, we may use the word United States or Canada in these podcasts, but we're talking about the whole advanced Western democracies, basically, right?
Yep, exactly. And what I wanted to add was your only chance for accumulating any wealth is either A, if you start some company that becomes really valuable, right? Like you have a startup with some idea, people invest, and it really grows in value. which is a very small percentage of the population, or you were able to save up enough money at a young age and be financially intelligent enough at a young age to be able to invest in real estate that's appreciated. But these are very minor percentages of the population. If all of your income comes from working, from earned income, it doesn't matter how much money you make, you have no chance of accumulating wealth.
I think that's right. I think that anybody who is an employee, and that's all they're doing, you know, and I don't think it matters, you know, whether they're $1 million employee or a $20,000 employee. I think that actually being an employee, yep, I think it's a ticket to serfdom. What do you think?
I agree 100%. I mean, I think if your sole source of income and wealth is from wages from employment, I think that you're a serf and you have very little chance to build any kind of wealth.
God. Yeah, although it sounds horrible, I think that you're right on that. So what's somebody supposed to do? I mean, let's say somebody's trying to start out in life. How do they navigate around this?
Listen, I mean, I think the options are really getting far less, right? I mean, I think either you have to, like I said, you have to start a business with other people's money and build its value so that your net worth comes from the increase in the value of the company that you started. And you can do that also by putting together real estate deals. It doesn't just have to be starting a business. Or you need to leave for greener pastures, right? You need to leave for countries where there's less competition for what you're doing and a more favorable tax regime.
Or you know, you try to organize your financial life so the tax systems don't touch it. And this would be, for example, you know, the super wealthy. We've talked about this, who basically can always avoid taxes. And in fact, that was the theme of our discussion.
But I mean, this kind of goes back to what I was, my first point was, most of the super wealthy have gotten super wealthy because they started a company that outside investors invested in, and then their wealth came through the appreciation of the value of that business, right? And so that's what I was saying. Within the system, your only chance at becoming super wealthy or accumulating wealth is really starting a business that is funded with other people's money that will allow you to grow it and scale it fast enough to be able to achieve, you know, significant value during your lifetime.
Or to put it another way, right? I mean, that works because it means that the value of the company is not subject to, you know, persistent harassment and taxation. I mean, the only way to do it is organize your life so your financial center of gravity is outside the tax system.
Right.
And that is what it means, you know, to set up a company and build the value of the asset, or that is what it means by, you know, investing in real estate or something where you have the possibility of gains, you know, that are not subject to immediate taxation.
Yep. For now.
It is a big, big problem. And it's becoming worse because one of the things that, you know, when Mr. Adams wrote this book, 30 years ago, it's published, right? 20 years in the making. I mean, certainly 50 years ago, people's lives were not completely driven and organized by the tax system, as at least to the extent that they are today, right?
That's correct.
I mean, now, you know, the danger is that every benefit, right, you know, is somehow you have to have a Social Security number, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's like the tax system has become the organizing principle of society, and which is crazy. And what makes it worse is these politicians talk this way. I mean, look at what's going on, you know, trying this whole Build Back Better thing. It's all about taxation. That's all it is.
Yeah, I mean, look, I remember going to what you were saying about preparing tax returns by hand. I remember when I got my in California, you need a license to be a tax preparer, unlike in most places in the United States. And I remember I took the class in order to get my tax preparer license in the mid-90s at some point. And we had to learn how to prepare tax returns by hand. And it was really complicated. But I remember when I first started preparing tax returns, that I was astounded that, you know, even then in California, about half your wages went to taxes. And I mean, that was, you know, that's also almost 30 years ago.
It's sobering, isn't it? There's nothing like preparing a tax return by hand a few days before it's due that drives that point home more clearly, is there?
That's very true.
You know, there's something about the computerization of it that I think masks a lot of this. But also, I mean, this is one of the great dangers of the digital age and computers is that it allows for these more complex tax laws, you know, to exist without people being aware of how they actually work. I mean, I wonder how many people actually, you know, understand, you know, the like throwback rules on foreign trusts or PFIC thing. I mean, you know.
Well, and I mean, look, the PFIC rules and the throwback tax rules, you know, I mean, luckily I don't have to do this anymore, but if I had to, I know how to calculate that by hand, right? Like I know how to do it. Those are manageable. But when you start looking at something like the transition tax, not even software was capable of handling it, John. Like even, you know, we run the most, I think probably the most expensive top of the line tax software in our tax preparation business called Lacerte. It's great software. But even this software was ill-equipped to handle it. It was too complicated for it to figure out. I mean, there was, and it was so complicated.
Well, and of course, it was very much compounded by the fact that that came out on what, December 17th, with tax returns due for many people in April. I mean, they're just simply, even if it hadn't been complicated, okay, yeah, there wasn't the time to respond.
Well, I mean, look, they push updates for this software, you know, almost weekly when they're making changes, right? So, I mean, most of this stuff was on extension and probably didn't get dealt with until August or September, you know, that it was filed. But even in that, it's still a relatively short amount of time. But, yeah, the software couldn't handle it, right? And even with a lot of the guilty stuff and things like that, a lot of the software doesn't handle it very well. It's extremely complex.
Well, yeah, because you've got, I mean, part of the complexity with that whole thing was the availability of the 962 election, right?
Yeah.
You know, so, if it wasn't bad enough the way it was written, okay, you know, you've got that, and then you've got, you know, sort of in parallel the possibility of the 968. It's impossible. I mean, you can't have a tax system based on things that nobody can understand, particularly when the people who don't understand it are the you know, the high-end CPAs and that are responsible for being able to communicate this stuff. But anyway,
sure.
Whoa. Yep, the tax system has reduced people to serfdom. No question. But I like the idea of tax avoidance for humanity as a concept. Listen,
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, let's, you know, set up a new division of the Esquire Group. You know, keep your, you know, billionaire side going, all right? But market this as an opportunity for the common man.
Well, you got to be really careful about marketing things that are marketing as tax avoidance, because that can really run afoul. You know, the IRS refers to schemes of avoidance and evasion, right? So, putting money in an IRA or using a corporation or something like that is not a scheme of avoidance. But if you set something up that they deem to be a scheme of avoidance, you're going to be on the radar in a way that you don't want to be. So,
oh my God. You mean even a lawful attempt to not give the government money is now illegal, is suspect. Well,
what they do, if you read their rules, they have in Circular 230, it refers to schemes of avoidance and evasion, right? Now, when you look at how that's defined, these schemes are like, I forget what they're called, but like a tax avoidance scheme is like, something that a promoter comes up with and then markets. Like, remember, I think there was this big Son of Boss case and stuff like this, or where they're trying to sell tax losses, or it's basically a scheme of avoidance is where you enter into kind of like a transaction that has no real business purpose other than the avoidance of tax, right? So you have to make sure whatever structures that you're putting in place to avoid tax, that it's not, a scheme of avoidance or evasion, and that it's really that there's a business purpose or some legitimate purpose behind it. Because if the only purpose is to avoid taxes, then you're going to run afoul of the IRS in a way you don't want to.
Well, I'm sure that's probably true, but what are people left with? What are people left with?
Serfdom, John. Serfdom.
Serfdom. Who was it? Hayek. What was the title of his book about serfdom? You're a closet libertarian, or maybe not even a closet. Yeah.
Maybe my closet, but which book?
It was one of Hayek's book about serfdom. Well, we can talk about it at some stage here. Anyway, this has been great. I hate to end on a depressive note. I really don't like the use of the word serfdom, but Charles Adams is an honest guy, isn't he?
That's my impression.
All right, Jimmy, how would people get a hold of you, whether for high-end tax planning or avoidance for humanity?
EsquireGroup.com.
All right, great. We'll pick it up next week. Thanks.
Thanks.